Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So as is evident to everyone here on the screen, we are proceeding today via video conference and Zoom. We are deeply appreciative for our ability to do that in light of the current pandemic and very much appreciate having both counsel present today. I know that you've already been given some instructions about what to do if you were to lose connectivity during the argument or just have any technical difficulties, and please know we'll accommodate that whatever way. To keep our record nice and clear, I'm going to ask the marshal to call the third case, and then I'll just have a couple of quick additional remarks.
Now calling case A210146, State of Minnesota versus Patrick James Motland.
And as counsel probably remembers and is well aware, what we ask you to do is before you start your argument, please identify yourself as well as the client that you represent. That will keep our audio record very clear, which is something that we later post on the court's website. All of our procedures, with the exception of the fact that we're not in a courtroom today, are the same as usual. And so you're familiar with all of those as to time limits and everything else. And then the second thing I'll ask you to do is please keep your eye on the clock. It does tend to go quickly. We really appreciate having both of you present and so that we can hear your responses and thoughts about this case. So with that, we're ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant Patrick Motland in this case. Motland raises three claims on appeal, but this morning I would like to focus on Motland's claim that the district court violated his right to confrontation when it refused to allow the removal of masks during witness testimony. While this claim involves timely questions regarding the right to confrontation in the context of a global pandemic, Motland's right to face-to-face confrontation and the constitutional test that must be satisfied before that right can be curtailed are both well-established and enduring. Face-to-face confrontation is at the core of a defendant's confrontation rights. It is embodied in the text of the clause itself. The absence of face-to-face confrontation is only constitutionally permissible when denial of confrontation is necessary to serve an important public policy and when the reliability of the testimony is otherwise assured. The test requires a district court to hear evidence and make findings in support of its ultimate determination that the absence of confrontation is permissible.
Ms. Graff, can we start off by, certainly Minnesota is not the only jurisdiction that has been requiring or strongly suggesting mask wearing given the pandemic. And certainly at the time of this trial, mask wearing was recommended strongly by the Center for Disease Control and the governing public health authorities in Minnesota. Is there any, and I'm sure other jurisdictions have addressed this issue as well in the context of a defendant's confrontation right, is there any jurisdiction anywhere in the United States that has held that the mask wearing requirement in a criminal trial is violative of a defendant's confrontation rights?
There are several federal district courts that have applied Craig to this question and have said because of confrontation issues, there will be no mask wearing during testimony permitted. And those cases have not gone up to courts of appeal yet, but there are I believe the District of New Mexico is one of them, and there were some others cited in appellant's brief that have concluded that Craig does require removal of masks during testimony. And those courts have universally determined that Craig is the standard.
Thank you.
So as I said, the Craig test requires that the court hear evidence and make findings. And here, the court stated that the analysis of the issue involved a balance, but Craig is not a balancing test. The court heard no evidence and didn't ultimately make any determination of either necessity or reliability as required. The state did not offer any evidence,
the first part of the test is it's necessary to further an important public policy. I mean, we had the pandemic. This is in September 2020. This is before the vaccine came out. This is very, very early on when Minnesota courts, only a few courts, were actually going back to having trials. And I know you raised the analogy of Chauvin, but Chauvin was much later after the vaccine, after we had already had some experience with respect to the courtroom and how to handle it. But it seems like the district court did actually look at and consider the public the important public policy. And I mean, isn't keeping people from getting sick and potentially dying with this pandemic in September 2020, isn't that an important public policy that would wearing a mask would further?
So I think that the court is that you're correct, Your Honor, that on a large scale, the pandemic and the spread of disease is an important public policy. But Craig requires more than a sort of general look at what is an important public policy. So in Craig, the issue there was the research tells us that child witnesses.
Right, right. And sorry to stop you, Ms. Graff, but I mean, when I look at what the district court said, in the context of the current pandemic, the court, mindful of the Minnesota constitutional Article 1, and goes in and talk about how the courtroom is small and the current state of research with respect to the risks, the risks of increased absent mask wearing. So it does seem that the court is talking specifics. The court isn't just talking, well, there's a pandemic, so everybody wear a mask. The court does get into specifics here.
I think that the only specific there is the size of the courtroom, but I don't think that that is sufficient under Craig that is required constitutionally. The court did address any, you know, case positivity rates in the area at the time. There's no specific discussion of each witness, the length of their testimony, their health risks. Those are the kinds of case-specific inquiries that need to be made before the confrontation right can be abrogated. So it's not Motlin's position that the pandemic or the spread of disease could never be or satisfy the necessity prong. It's just that in this particular case, the district court didn't consider and make the case-specific findings of fact underlying any decision to require masking. And keep in mind that the context of this trial was...
Counsel, is there some authority that sets a baseline for how many findings the district court has to make? I mean, she did cite the current state of the research. She did cite the pandemic. She noted the size of the courtroom, and there was other discussion about how the courtroom cannot accommodate spectators. And we can talk about that issue if you'd like as well. But I mean, how many more findings does the district court have to make here?
So,
and what's the authority for that?
I would point the court to Craig, and the court's references to the general research about mask wearing or the current state of the pandemic are akin to the general science that's referred to in Craig about child witnesses testifying in front of defendants in child abuse cases. And the court there says, That's the sort of baseline that we need. But then in every case, it is required, you know, in Craig, there was expert testimony, but some sort of specific fact-based determination that in this particular case, at this particular time, given these particular participants, as well as the other safety measures in place here, we have to keep in mind that this courtroom was arranged so that witnesses, social distancing was maintained with witnesses and all other participants. All other participants were masked. There was a shield or barrier near the court reporter. All of that is in the record as the other safety measures that were in place. So what the court had to do was say, even though all these other measures are in place and given the current state where we are right now, based on these data points and this information, this mask wearing is still a necessity. And the court never said that. So that, and then the record doesn't bear that out here. So,
well, Ms. Graff, what binding, I mean, I know you're referring to Craig, but is there any, let me ask you this question. Is there any binding Minnesota authority specifying what minimum findings are required? I mean, because when we review the findings, we just have to make sure that there are sufficient findings for us to be able to review. And based on what the district court said here, it seems like there's more than sufficient for us to understand why these measures are being taken. And I mean, the idea of that they have a small courtroom, I mean, you can see a picture of our courtroom behind us. Our courtrooms are not that large either. They're certainly not as large as the Minnesota Supreme Court. And you know, if you've been in them, you can see that all of a sudden 6 feet distancing between people can become rather challenging. And even in the Chauvin case that you referenced, they only allowed two witnesses and or two people from the press and two family members. And those courtrooms are larger than the ones in Isanti County. So why, I mean, isn't really the standard, as long as there's sufficient findings for us to review, isn't that enough?
No, well, the question of whether there's a confrontation violation is subject to this court's de novo review. That question is a de novo standard. So Motlin's position is that given the limited information in the record and the limited analysis by the district court, while he's not challenging those limited factual findings, is that the ultimate determination of necessity and reliability here is not appropriate, and that resulted in a confrontation violation. So though that question is subject to this court's de novo consideration. And I think that the other piece of this puzzle is, of course, the reliability prong. And you know, obscuring witnesses' faces during the entirety of their testimony obscured the jury's ability to judge their credibility and their reliability. Appellant cited People versus Sammons and his brief, which is a pre-pandemic but mask-wearing case applying Craig. And there the court discussed the importance of demeanor and an ability to see a witness's face, and that the jury often learns more from the witness's face than from the words that the witness speaks. So even if the necessity prong were to be satisfied on this record, there's still a question of whether the measures used here preserved the essence of effective confrontation.
But wasn't that case one where the mask covered the person's face entirely, unlike masks that we wear now?
It appears from the record that it covered the sort of the head, but that the eyes were visible. And so the witness there was able to see the defendant, and the court said, nonetheless, this obstructed the ability of the fact finder to determine credibility. And I don't think that the confrontation right should sort of rise and fall on whether the forehead is not covered. I think People versus Sammons and the logic there applies with equal force in this case.
Counsel, I see that you are dwindling down on time, and I do want to address the Crawford issue that you, or the confrontation clause issue that's raised with respect to the body camera footage. My question to you about that is, assuming that the admission of the body camera footage with Officer Gilquist, with his statement, that hearsay statement, that was plain error. My question to you is whether that error affected the defendant's substantial rights when his own counsel on cross-examination elicited additional testimony from the officer about the location of the methamphetamine in the back of the vehicle, independent of the hearsay statement.
I think that the answer to the question is yes. That was counsel's attempt to deal with the fact that Deputy Vandervet didn't observe the location itself on cross-examination. That doesn't change the fact that in his direct testimony and through the state's admission of the body-worn camera video, that the evidence came in first that way, and that it was the only evidence that the state offered to prove the location of the methamphetamine. And when I say location, I don't just mean the location within the vehicle. I mean its location at all. So without that statement, the state could not prove possession.
Well, why is it that it was, why are you characterizing it as counsel's attempt to deal with the statement? It didn't, it doesn't, when I'm reading pages 437 to 442 of the transcript, it doesn't look like that to me. So can you explain that a little bit more?
Certainly. So this came up in the context of appellant's counsel's cross-examination. And my reading of the transcript is to point out to the jury that he didn't have any personally observe the methamphetamine's location.
Yes. And then he introduced the evidence of the, or the document with the evidence log. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And but it remains the case that the statements were the only evidence of the methamphetamine's location.
And when I see you that say statements, and when we say statements by whom?
The statement of Sergeant Gilquist on the video and the testimony of the Deputy Vandervet who did testify at trial regarding what Gilquist told him.
Well, when he testified at trial, I'm sorry, I see that your time's up. Do you mind, Judge Bratfield, if I thank you? I mean, his testimony at trial wasn't Officer Gilquist told me he found it there. It was he found it there in a Tupperware in the back seat.
It was that to the extent it was without reference to Sergeant Gilquist, we know from the record that that is the only basis for his knowledge is Sergeant Gilquist's statement of as to where it was. And we know that from the body-worn camera video because Deputy Vandervet says, where was it? Meaning he didn't observe it himself and he relied on Sergeant Gilquist for that information. Thank you.
Anything further from the panel? Of course, we'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. All right. Sounds good. We will move ahead to respondent's argument and the clock has been reset. So counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, judges. Joel Whitlock for the respondent. Thanks for having me today. I realize the appellant focused primarily on the mask situation. There was some very pertinent questions as it relates to that. I certainly can revisit that issue as necessary. I know there's been no questions about the closure of the courtroom. There's a discussion as it relates to what needs to happen with the closure of the courtroom. I would simply indicate that the courtroom was never actually closed. There was no preemptive clearing of the courtroom. There was no desire by any family or friends to appear, and they were unable to do so. The courtroom was open the entire time. So there's much about whether the courtroom was
counsel,
closed.
What is your best legal authority for that? That this is not a closure because, you know, there were some individuals in the courtroom, the participants in the trial. But as I read the transcript and the district court's order, the public was not allowed into the courtroom where the defendant was, and the public was in a separate courtroom. They were seeing the public in that courtroom, saw the trial via live video, but it's still different. So would you help me out with legal authority for that argument?
Well, I'm not necessarily able to help you with the legal authority. It's just the facts of the situation. There was discussion as to how the courtroom was set up with the overflow that was put into the record, but not to any actual public. At no time during the trial was there ever any public attempting to come into the courtroom. We had the jurors, we had court administration, we had the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the defendant, the judge's clerk, and my staff was coming and going with the witnesses. The witnesses were certainly sequestered, but there was no family or friends. This was never brought up as an issue as it relates to any particular person. The door was open. Had a public individual come in, there may have been a further discussion as it relates to whether they could be seated in the courtroom or separately watching the other overflow via ITV. That did not occur. That's just what was set up to accommodate any public.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, counsel, your position is that notwithstanding the live feed in an adjacent courtroom, the door to the courtroom during this trial, the entirety of the trial was open and it was accessible to the public.
Yes. I went in and out for every particular witness I had to acquire.
Well, with all due respect, counsel, you are different than the public. You're counsel.
But the door was open and nobody ever came in the course of this trial. There were no family and friends. I tried 15 felony jury trials a year and we never have people other than a handful of times a family. There were no family here.
And there was no sign on the door saying that that the courtroom is closed and that public can watch the live feed. Was none Correct. Of that?
Correct. What was put in the record was the protocol that was going to be in place if needed. And if it actually had occurred, we would be arguing about something else. So that's all I really want to say about the closure at this point in time.
Oh, so just one quick question. I'm a bit confused because the language I read from the district court suggested that the court made a real specific decision that the public was going to be seated in the alternate courtroom with the live video feed. So now a district court's verbal orders are still in order. So the fact that there wasn't a sign on the door or a lock on the door, I'm not quite following your argument, and maybe that's just me, and we can move on.
And again, I appreciate that. That was the intention. Had it actually occurred, then I would be arguing whether that was appropriate or not. But in this case, it doesn't even apply because there were no public attempts to get into the courtroom. No one was made to watch the court proceedings from another room. There was no sign on the door. The door was not locked. There was no personnel indicating you cannot come in. That may have been the intention of the court. But had there been someone, we would have had a discussion about this. Again,
why don't you go ahead then and talk about the case law that suggests there are four Waller factors that the district court should find before issuing an order like the one that we had in place here.
Certainly, Waller seems to be the guidance here. But again, when we're looking at a closure, one for a particular interest, the state did not ask for the court to be closed. The defendant did not ask for the courtroom to be closed. What was pronounced by the judge was as it relates to her understanding and belief that was necessary under the protocols that were put in place during COVID. So I don't know that Waller is applicable. That's what I'm trying to say. But if it was, then there would have had to have been some discussion. And again, all due respect, Judge, that this wasn't required at this point in time in the trial because there was no need for it. So I if you really want me to go further into Waller, I can. But I really wasn't prepared to do that so much because it wasn't necessary. And the question I think would be, if it had been necessary, would this have been appropriate?
So again, I'm just trying to make sure I understand your argument. You say it's not necessary to do a Waller analysis because the public didn't attempt to come in or because Right. The parties didn't ask for closure. I'm just not sure which way you're going on that.
In this case, no public was ever attempted to come in. So there was no prejudice in that regard.
Mr. Whitlock, I'd like to ask some questions on the third issue of the body cam and whether that testimony from the deputy, I'm sorry, from the sergeant was admissible. And let's assume for the sake of argument that the body cam testimony was not admissible, that it was inadmissible hearsay. What other admissible evidence shows that the methamphetamine was located in the car? And I really want to focus on other evidence other than the testimony by the deputy and the sergeant, because really the one, it just echoes the other. So Certainly. What is the admissible evidence showing that the methamphetamine was located in the backseat of the car?
Prior to the statement that's in question here, there was a finding of a meth pipe on the defendant or the appellant.
And let me just be clear. What I'm focusing on is the 23 grams of Correct. Methamphetamine that was found in the back, not the pipe or anything else.
Right. Following the discovery of the pipe, they conducted a canine sniff of the vehicle that appellant was driving and was the sole occupant at the time that he was stopped. Then they engaged in a search of the vehicle based upon that hit by the canine. Deputy Vandervet started in the front at the driver's side door. Sergeant Gilquist started on the same side in the back seat. Drugs were found. the statement was as it relates to where the drugs were found in the vehicle, but the drugs were found during the search of the vehicle. The jury got to see a search of the vehicle, knowing that's what the two individuals were going to do based upon the canine sniff.
Okay, but just to be clear, the deputy never saw where the drugs were, correct?
Deputy Vandervet asked after it was pronounced.
Well, that's not my question, counsel. Did the deputy ever see where the drugs were located in the car?
Deputy Vandervet was in the front. He did not see the drugs as they were found.
Okay, and he never saw the drugs in the car himself.
The drugs were being removed from the car when he first observed them. So he, not in the car.
But the deputy never saw the drugs in the car himself, did he? His testimony is that he didn't see them himself.
Correct. He saw Deputy Gilquist as he removed them from the car. So he asked where in the car, but he knew right. It was in the car.
Right. But he did not know that where the drugs were found, because when he inquired, the Sergeant Gilquist was holding them up at the time, and he was holding them up outside of the car.
Absolutely. You're correct.
Okay. So the deputy never saw the drugs himself, and he never saw them in the car, and he never saw them being actually removed from the car.
Correct. He was aware that drugs were found during the search of the car by the two law enforcement officers present. So drugs were only to be found in the car. There was no else for them to be found.
Well, but that's an inference that's based on the hearsay statement by Sergeant Gilquist, though. He found the drugs in the car.
It's also an inference from his presence there. So it's certainly reinforced by this statement when he asked where they were found.
But it's based on inadmissible. We're assuming for the sake of argument that's based on inadmissible hearsay, though.
I don't think Deputy Vandervet's awareness of the drugs being found is limited to Sergeant Gilquist's statement. He was fully aware that there was his colleague was searching the vehicle and found drugs, and they were found in the vehicle. He himself didn't see the drugs in the vehicle until after the statement was made, but they were only found in the vehicle.
Right. And what I'm just trying to get to, what evidence is there, assuming for the sake of argument, just for the sake of argument here, that the statements by Sergeant Gilquist are inadmissible hearsay and the statements by Deputy Vandergilt are also inadmissible hearsay because they're based on inadmissible hearsay from Sergeant Gilquist. So what is there any other evidence that supports the conclusion that the drugs were actually indeed located in the car?
I can't think of anything else other than the knowledge that that's the only place that was being searched. So as a result of the search, they were found.
Okay. Another question related to that is, so when we look under the plain error standard, one of the things that we look at is whether or not the person's rights have been substantially prejudiced substantial rights have been affected. And one of the things that we look at is whether or not there is other ways that this evidence could have come in. And Sergeant Gilquist never testified. My question is, why didn't he testify? Wouldn't it have been better to have him testify, since he's the one that actually is the one who is supposed to have found the drugs in the car?
Deputy Gilquist was the person who pulled the appellant over. Deputy Gilquist is the one that asked, Deputy Vandervet pulled the appellant over. Deputy Vandervet is the one that questioned about his identity. Deputy Vandervet was the one that was going to secure him to bring him to the jail to determine his identity. Deputy Vandervet is the one that found the meth pipe that led to the canine sniff. Deputy Vandervet's decision was to search the vehicle. All of this was played out on body camera, both individuals. Deputy Vandervet not only testified, but he laid foundation for the video of all this interaction. Sergeant Gilquist only would have been there to lay foundation for the video of his body cam, which is almost identical information. He showed up immediately after Deputy Vandervet did and was on scene. It would have been another hour of duplicative video. And I guess I would ask the court to consider whether the questions as it relates to defendant's appellant's counsel at the time of trial was strategy, because if he had objected to the playing that's in question right now, all the state would have had to do is bring in Sergeant Gilquist and play the entirety of that video all over, which was not necessarily something that the appellant would have wanted to have happen. It would have been duplicative and it would have been prejudicial. So
aren't the confrontation rights personal to the defendant? Doesn't the defendant have to waive those personally? It can't be just a matter of trial strategy.
And certainly you're correct in that regard. And again, as it relates to the hearsay that's being objected to, there was no objection in the moment. And that would be the best place for this to have been determined whether there's a remedy for if that was hearsay objection had been sustained, the state could have gone around that by having Sergeant Gilquist come in and testify, or there could have been a possible examination as it related to an exception that might have been applying. I know the present sense impression.
Right. And Mr. Whitlock, I appreciate that argument. I think you're making a very valid point there. But my only question is, the state had approved possession. And because the state did not present any direct evidence that he actually possessed it, it relied on a constructive possession argument. But wouldn't it have been better just to have him go up there for 5 minutes and say, yes, I went in there and I took the drugs, and I found the drugs behind the back seat. I don't know if that really requires playing the whole body cam video over again. I think are we just talking about Sergeant Gilquist just saying, I'm the one who found the drugs and this is where I found them? So it's a credibility determination that the jury has to make at that point.
It could have happened that way and it didn't. And that's why we have this issue before the panel. But again, there was no objection. That would have been the best place to determine whether there is any kind of detriment here to the appellant and how the state could have possibly overcome it, to include arguing for exceptions or just simply bringing in the deputy at that point. That would not have been foreclosed. And if this is strategy, and then they have a backup plan to appeal it as it relates to the confrontation clause in this case. And clearly, as it was pointed out in the earlier questions, not only was there no objection, there was continued cross-examination of this very evidence. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions for respondent? Doesn't look like. Okay. All right. So we've reset the clock and we are ready for 5 minutes of rebuttal from appellant if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus on the public trial issue, and I think that it is very clear from this record that the public was relegated to a separate room, that they were not permitted to be in the courtroom. That is what the district court ordered. There is nothing to the contrary in the record. Respondents' counsel has referred to the courtroom being unlocked, the absence of a sign, that no member of the public was actually had to observe in the other courtroom. And that's, to the extent it's not in the record, much of that is not in the record. And I believe there actually is a place in the record where there was a conversation about there being somebody in the overflow room, but the mics in the courtroom not working at the time counsel was sort of off the record in the courtroom. So much of what respondent has referred to here is either not in or contradicted by the record that we do have. I also think respondent's argument on this claim sort of puts the cart before the horse and says, well, we didn't have to get to Waller because nobody actually tried to come in. And that is not how the Waller analysis works. And it's not the constitutional mandate of Waller. And all of those steps must be followed before the closure occurs. And here, it's unquestionable that the public was not permitted to be present for the proceedings, that this was a true closure. And and the remaining Waller factors were not addressed by the district court. I think in this case in particular, we have evidence in the record that at some point the court did designate a place where an employee from the county attorney's office could stay in the courtroom if she chose to do so, and said, you'd need to be over here. And in respondent's brief, essentially, they concede that there was room for perhaps one other person to be present. The court never addressed that or permitted that when saying the public is in this place with this live feed. So on the factors in Waller, which required the court to consider alternatives and required the closure not to be overly broad, those two things by themselves, the closure fails on those prongs and warrant reversal alone. I also want to address respondent's reference to prejudice and the lack of request by either party that the courtroom be closed. First of all, courtroom closure is a structural error, so we're not looking at prejudice or any sort of harmless error analysis like, well, nobody showed up, which again is not in the record, but that's simply absent from the legal question before the court. And I would also just point to Presley versus Georgia for a discussion of what the district court's duty is. In that case, the Supreme Court said that trial courts are obligated to take every reasonable measure to accommodate public attendance at criminal trials. And the public has a right to be present regardless of whether any party objects or raises the issue. That duty is a constitutional one. And in Presley, the court actually reversed a decision by the Supreme Court of Georgia that said, well, the court wasn't obligated to consider alternatives because nobody asked it to. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's the court's obligation. Those obligations are reflected in our Minnesota rules of criminal procedure that mirror the Waller factors as well. So I believe that in this case, we do have a public trial violation. It's determinable based on the even just those two factors of Waller, which require reasonable alternatives and closure that is not overly broad. I think respondent also sort of puts the cart before the horse too, in terms of the hearsay issue, sort of saying, well, he knew the drugs were found in the car because that's where they were found. But again, it sort of begs the question of how he knew that. And for the reasons we've argued in this case, that was a plain error. The pandemic has changed many things.
So, counsel, before you finish the plain error analysis on hearsay, there is some case law that I think counsel for respondent alluded to that would suggest that the defendant's failure to object to the hearsay really foreclosed the state then from establishing the basis for the admission or for taking alternative steps, such as calling Officer Gilquist to the stand. And there is some case law that has refused to look at plain error of hearsay objections, or rather hearsay evidence that is not objected to on that grounds. So would you respond to that?
Certainly, I see that my time is up, but with your permission. Yes, those cases refuse to proceed when it's not clear and obvious that the evidence is hearsay. I think we have a very clear and obvious example of hearsay in this case. None of the exceptions that respondent proposed in its brief bear out in terms of allowing the evidence to come in under an exception. So I think this is one of those cases that the plain error analysis can proceed because it is clear and obvious that this was inadmissible hearsay.
Judge Bracknell, may I ask a follow-up question?
Yes.
I know I've been doing that all morning, but thanks. I appreciate that. I want to follow up, Ms. Graff, on that point, because, I mean, I think Mr. Whitlock raised a good point there in terms of state never had the opportunity to argue that a hearsay exception existed or even call a rebuttal witness to clarify that point, which may have only taken a few minutes by calling the sergeant. Why should we consider this on appeal? Because these are issues of admissibility of evidence, and we're just an error-correcting court. Aren't these issues that really are better suited for the district court to make decisions on as to whether this evidence is indeed admissible, and if so, under what exceptions? The state raised at least two possibilities in its brief, including the residual hearsay exception, which is a fairly broad exception. So why should we even consider this on appeal?
Well, I think that the lack of objection is already accounted for in the fact that appellant has argued it under the plain error standard. And in terms of the exceptions proposed by respondent, in appellant's reply, I've addressed both of those exceptions. Neither of them fits the situation here. One of them actually requires the declarant to testify, which we know didn't happen. The other, the residual exception, requires notice and I guess I'll shorten it to say some sort of need that the state can't otherwise secure the evidence that it seeks to admit under that rule. So neither of those fit what happened here.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, for the reasons argued in appellant's brief, he would ask for a reversal and a remand for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. So our gratitude to both lawyers in this case. This matter was very helpful to us to hear your arguments and for you to answer our questions. And so we very much appreciate having you here today.